This is an APA podcast focusing on equity in practice. I'm Roberta Rewers, Senior Communications Manager for APA. Joining me today is Bobby Boone, Founder and Chief Strategist of And Access, a retail real estate and urban planning consultancy focusing on solutions for underinvested communities and historically excluded entrepreneurs. Thanks for joining me today, Bobby.
Thanks for having me.
You spoke at NPC 23 about anti-displacement strategies, including identifying not only risks, but opportunities for small and local businesses. Where did your focus on displacement start for small businesses and local businesses?
Ooh, good question. So my educational background is architecture and urban planning. I've always been really interested in commercial environments because what I find is that's where everyone enters. Acts, right? It's like, you know, you and I could be next to each other in the grocery store or sit next to each other in a bar and have the same conversation, hopefully. And so from that, it was just like, you know, how can we amplify that opportunity for neighborhoods and communities in recognizing the value that a lot of the small businesses actually have in that equation. You know, when I think about that value, I think about the neighborhoods that oftentimes are overlooked by the, you know, national brands, the ones who are, you know, say, hey, we have this very formulaic like site selection process. You know, Applebee's, we only opened up 26 locations in 2022. That's not a real stat, but it's, you know, thinking about it from a like pure like quantitative standpoint, and you know, neighborhood oriented businesses that are grown organically, you know, from, you know, residents of a community, they are much more like, hey, I can afford the space is large enough, and you know, it's near who my customers will be, right? And so, all right, well, let me think about how to like serve them and then create this, you know, organic neighborhood. You know, one of the business owners I work with in Maryland, she was saying, hey, you know, when I first started my business, I thought it was my business, right? But actually it's the community's business. Like, and that's so real, you know, and you think about like, hey, I can't be successful without a community around me that's truly supporting the vision of growth, vision of like equity for my community that is like entrenched and so like impassioned, and it's also doing what they love. And so like figuring out like, all right, how do we get to that solution? How do we get to solutions that are truly rooted in I'm doing something for the people around me while doing something that also serves me.
I think that makes a lot of sense because like being in Philadelphia for NPC 23, mm-hmm. what I personally loved was the smaller businesses. It wasn't the traditional chains. Like I got to try a really cool local bagel shop and I was like, oh my gosh, this was so great. And I'm like, why can't we have one of these back home? Yes. Like, so even as a visitor, you get to that sense of community and the vibes and the differences. And it's just, it's not standard monotony.
Right.
So why do you do what you do then? Because this sounds like really hard work.
The work itself is personally rejuvenating. You know, the operations of having a small business is the hard part, you know, honestly. However, you know, when I think about why I do what I do, so I grew up in Atlanta. You know, where it was a community that's, you know, I'm African American male, and it's a community that, you know, is largely African American. You know, my pediatrician was black, the Jamaican shop owner, you know, of course, was black, and you know that my dad and I went to at least once a week because he loved jerk chicken and he still does. And you know, thinking about, you know, like going downtown, you saw a lot of black people. It was just so entrenched with blackness and black business at every single scale. And when I think about, you know, community serving businesses, that's like, you know, for me personally was like, you know, how I was like initially introduced to what my whole life could be, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think about it as like self-actualization. It's like, you know, as a youth, you see a business owner like, huh, they're doing something I really love to do. I can do that, or I can do that, or I can do that. And so for me, it goes back to, how do we give people opportunities to chase their dreams and see that it's real? And so translating that over to the built environment and planning, right, it's like, you know, all right, in order to do that, you need the right policies behind it. You need the right educational opportunities. You need also, households with discretionary income so that they could actually shop at the businesses. You need the, physical development opportunities, like adequate space in place. So it's like you need facade improvement programs and roof repair and, from a lot of these, chronically disinvested assets too. And so it's just like, why I do what I do is because I recognize that it's not a one size fit all puzzle piece of like solving for getting to that self-actualization for the youth. You need to have all of these things, from financing to planning to development, to entrepreneurial ecosystem or business support services, et cetera, in place in order to move that strategy forward. And so, I am really driven by figuring out all those pieces and learning from all those pieces in order to move the planning profession forward, in order to move the neighborhoods we serve forward.
It does not sound like easy work at all. What do you see as some of the obstacles that planners have to face in helping small businesses, smaller community businesses, overcome displacement issues?
It's a tall order.
not easy, right?
So, I think it's one mindset, right? It is shifting from a pull yourself up from the bootstraps or a, the information is online in some cryptic language mm-hmm. perspective, to one that is rooted in empathy, one that is rooted in how can I truly, use the power that I have as a planner in order to serve the people on the other side. And so, when you get to the technical aspects of that, it is, hey, we are largely working on land use, and those land use controls, the land use approvals, all of the things. And so understanding, one, what is inhibiting small businesses from operating, what's inhibiting more so culturally specific small businesses from operating, and how do you move those barriers remove those barriers to enable that behavior. So, one thing I thought about, which is, I worked in Fort Worth, Indiana in 2019. And then, it's a large Burmese population there. And one of the things that we noted in our research and, some of the clients team told us about was, hey, they're having livestock in their backyard or they're, growing things that, typically isn't allowed to be grown, at the scale, right, in their backyards. And it's just like, well, neighbors are complaining. And I was like, well, you have a large immigrant population here that has culturally specific needs about how they live. And you are more so forcing them to adopt a westernized culture of how I need to do that, instead of saying, hey, you can do that in these parameters. Right. And so maybe we have, a few plots that are available, for the storage of livestock. Maybe we, mm-hmm. So you can have up to 5 chickens in your backyard. And so it's just like, really figuring out strategies that supports that behavior. And then moving it into the retail context, right? It's like, hey, what does that look like in tandem? Right. And so that's you talk about a lot, in retail about experiential retail and shopping, and that's like a whole trend and driving a lot of what's occurring in most major brands. And when you think about experiential, you think about like, oh, this is something I would come back to. Yesterday I was in Chinatown, went to a hot pot restaurant, And, you know, we had, you know, our boiling hot pot. And it was like, oh, you just go up and pick all of the skewers that you want to dip in the hot pot. And you don't order it and we bring it to you. You know, that's a part of the experience, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it was, you know, in these beautiful refrigerators, you know. And it was just like, wow, you know, I would come back here with my daughter because – it's such a, like, very interesting and different cultural, like, dining experience. And so being able to be very specific in how cultures can show up is a big part of that answer.
It makes sense because then it's not, we're not all the same. We get to experience different opportunities. Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit about inhibiting operations and businesses and stuff. Can mm-hmm. you give a few examples of, like, some of that? You did a little bit with, you know, community culture, having livestock in their backyards. Mm-hmm. What are some other examples that you've come across?
One of the things I think about with specific, like, African American or like Black people in general, they historically have had to smoke meats, mm-hmm. you know, and that is, the smoking is a preservation technique, right? And so in order to do that, you need space and great ventilation. Historically, you don't have a lot of space and ventilation in urban centers. But now in modern age, there's so much technology in terms of the building that can remove all of that, those, you know, that smoke and exhaust that into, you know, above the building, you know, elsewhere, etc. And so I find that, you know, sometimes the code is slow to pick up on the technology, right, that is available. And so figuring out strategies and really which you could say, hey, we know this preparation technique is important to your culture and we're enabling it through legislation. And so that's one. You know, I will also think about, you know, the sizes of space requirements. You know, some municipalities have, like, hey, you must have 25 seats to be considered a restaurant. That limits, you know, the ability for somebody that's, you know, like, hey, I know I make bomb empanadas mm-hmm. and I'm gonna, you know, I only need 250 square feet to make bomb empanadas. And I want to sell them at my front door, or I want to have, you know, a bar of 8 stools in, you know, pickup register in order, like, to facilitate that, like, business. And so how do we, you know, ensure that our space size limitations, the parking requirements that come along with that, you know, are removed? How do we promote smaller spaces mm-hmm. in terms of, like, actually identifying, say, hey, you know, we're having a zoning code for 500 square feet. So when developers and, you know, their architects, et cetera, are designing the buildings, they're saying, oh, if we do this, we can, like, limit how much parking we have to have. And then it's like, it's a financial value for them then. So if we're like, oh, we're going to put, you know, 3 500 square foot bays in our building in order to support, you know, it's not supporting small business from their perspective sometimes, but it is supporting that small business that will occupy that space because, you know, we're only, you know, in commercial real estate, you charge per square foot. Mm-hmm. And so it comes down to, you know, really figuring out creative solutions that, you know, aligns with, you know, financial interests, which aligns with cultural interest and community needs.
Not a challenge at all.
Not at all.
Speaking of challenges, one of them for small businesses is not having readily available data, especially for minority-owned or minority-serving mm-hmm. districts. How do we remedy that gap in getting the data? Or, you know, what do we do if we, you know, you can't go to a web page and find the data set that you need? How do we move forward?
So I'm going to say big dream and then in practice. So, like, big dream is federal government starts to, you know, really shine light on that specific data, those specific data points, right? They, you know, from your taxes, you know, if you're a single member LLC or, you know, corporation, you have data on, you know, employees, all that stuff, mostly financial, right? And that you can find through the census, the annual business survey, which, you know, was like 2017, which is like the most rich just data set. But, you know, in terms of ethnicity and things, but that, you know, is largely a hard kind of data set to like access in terms of, you know, just the lay person on the street and figuring out who's in their community. And it, you know, it's outdated because it's 2017. But it's like, as we're moving into the future, if the federal government was really able to say, hey, you know, in your taxes every year, how do you identify? Mm-hmm. You know, what are your NAICS codes, you know? And be able to share that information with municipalities, or share that information with community organizations, or share that information with other, you know, community-minded organizations who are trying to do the work that is serving, you know, the specific populations there. And so that's, you know, one solution, you know, which is pie in the sky dreams right now. But at the municipal level, or as a planner level, it's like, you know, one of the things I've really loved is the New York City Storefront Registry. And so, you know, New York City has recognized, hey, commercial rents are all over the place, right? And many of them noted as too high, specifically within some of the more dense Manhattan neighborhoods. And so thinking about how do you understand, like, how to put in a rent control ordinance. You don't have that conversation easily without having the data to support it. And so what they recognize is, you know, hey, commercial leases aren't regulated, so they aren't standardized. You'll have different rent terms in terms of triple net or gross, or, you know, single nets, you know, all these things that, you know, very technical, very jargony, doesn't mean the same thing when you actually look at the dollar value. But now we need to start, you know, diving into the why. What I learned yesterday also was, hey, they did that. The first rung of data was amazing. And then developers and property owners realized, oh, this could really dampen kind of what we could charge long term, right? And so they pulled back on their transparency in actually the provision of data. And so, you know, it's a great tool, right? In terms of like, hey, we're gonna, you know, all properties with ground floor, second story retail have to like put, you know, into this registry. But, you know, if it's only as good as the people who are providing the data. So figuring out innovative ways to collect data is one. You know, one of the things I really think about is, you know, we have a lot of AI technology that's starting to be developed. It's like, how do we leverage that in tandem with, you know, a Google Maps to really look, say, hey, what's the building condition? What, you know, scraping Google to understand the point data of each business location. Are they temporarily closed, permanently closed, you know, triangulating that data with Yelp, you know, all of these things. So I think it's a technology tool that should exist somewhere. And to be able to really monitor this information over time.
In your session at MPC 23, you were talking about an anti-displacement dashboard for community organizations. Can you talk a little bit more about the dashboard?
Of course. So two things. So I started internal project based from my Robert Louis Johnson fellowship with the Culture of Health Leaders. And so, you know, they gave some seed funding to start a strategic initiative. I entitled it In Place. And the whole purpose of In Place is really to figure out what's a new financial tool for commercial property stabilization and long-term occupancy of the businesses who have historically, you know, served this community but are at risk because the neighborhood is gentrifying in terms of, you know, new residents moving in, additional development occurring nearby, property values increasing, therefore rent rates increasing. And so with that, you know, we launched a few research tactics. One, which, you know, is available currently, is the survey data. And so that data dashboard really looks at, you know, hey, how can we complement this conversation that we have around access to capital for businesses with what are the true challenges of storefront businesses? How are neighborhood changes impacting profitability of those businesses? What are their actual rent rates for those who own? What are their mortgage rates? How do they compare? Where is the interest of ownership? And so are people actually interested in owning their commercial property as a business owner or not? How does that segment across different racial makeups and compositions of the ownership profiles, et cetera? So it's like it's a lot of data around those things. And, you know, that data is live and available on our website, and you can actually request the raw data from us because we're only trying to provide that information similar to like this developer conversation we just had, right? Like, you know, hey, developers realize like it might not be in our interest to have this data. For me, it's like, maybe if you're a developer, I might not want to give you this information, right? It's like, because I don't necessarily want you to like make decisions that are just based upon true return on investment in a financial standpoint. And so, you know, you can request it. So all planners who are listening, hopefully we'll do that. And then, you know, we're transitioning to the second point is, you know, this displacement risk dashboard. And so this is looking specifically at neighborhood indicators that is talking about change both on the leading side and the lagging. So leading is like, hey, how's the, you know, the population of the neighborhood changing? You know, how many sales transactions have occurred? Also looking at, you know, are there parcels that have been acquired by a corporation, a developer likely, that are large recently, or, you know, where is their consolidated ownership, and how can we understand that relationship to the businesses that are there? And so that has taken way longer than I expected it to, for many reasons, but, you know, largely it's because, you know, I want to be very intentional about the methodology. Two is, if you ever, like, you know, try to get additional philanthropic funds, it sometimes takes a really long time. And so thinking about, you know, really being able to like do the work well and also run a consulting practice, we're at that nexus right now. And so I am working with the University of Maryland's National Center of Smart Growth on the Purple Line, that is looking at, you know, how can we do this at a very granular approach. And so I'm looking forward to taking that addition, that methodology that we've developed at the national scale, and pulling it down, and so we'll have something that's replicable for a lot of communities across the nation.
Purple Line for DC Metro.
Yes.
So take us to DC Metro Maryland. What's going on there?
Okay. So it's a lot of things going on, but I'll talk a little bit more specifically about the Purple Line. So, you know, DC Metro in Maryland is primarily composed of Montgomery and Prince George's County. And those two counties are, you know, a yin and yang in many instances. You know, Prince George's County has historically been the most, or one of the most, more modern ages, affluent African-American counties in the nation, where, you know, Montgomery County is home to a lot of biomed industries, as well as, you know, others that, you know, have been supporting, you know, other industries, but, you know, specifically housing, you know, NIH and Walter Reed and all of those things. And so, you know, when you think about the Purple Line, the goal there is connecting, my own words, connecting the two communities, right? It's like, you know, it's this arch that's going between a few of the rail lines in the existing Metro Rail system, which, you know, the red, I think the orange line from Bethesda to New Carrollton. And so with that, you know, it's cutting through many commercial corridors. These commercial corridors have historically been suburban, you know, without access to rail, and so not as much transit-oriented development that has really been promoted and occurring within the DC metro area over the last, I would say, 20 years. And now they have that development pressure, right? It's like, oh, there's a new rail line coming in. And so, and these communities are, a lot of them are minority, you know, across various different segments. And they're, some of them are lower income. And so figuring out, you know, really strategies to like support those communities who have these very vibrant business environments. You know, one of the businesses I talked about earlier that I was supporting, you know, talking about like, hey, the community is like a business for my community and not for me. She's on this line. Right. And so it really, you know, it is a neighborhood where we're just trying to figure out how to like put in the like supports now before the line is completed, before new development happens into place in order to really support those businesses. And so, you know, largely from my perspective, it is an opportunity really to drive the conversation around like what's the role of public investment in terms of transportation that typically happens in communities and then like spurs redevelopment right after that and then puts many communities at risk. Mm-hmm. And how do you navigate that trajectory in a way that when you look at those risk factors, it's like they're actually being able to be mitigated for.
Before we lose the businesses.
Yes.
Makes sense. And Access is working with Sweet Auburn Works. We're going to transition down back to Atlanta. We kind of started in Atlanta. We'll come back to Atlanta.
Yes.
To launch a retail incubator program. Talk to me about the program. What's the foundation of it? What's the goal? Have you come across any like, oh, we didn't expect to see that come up?
So the program is intended to make experience design interventions for businesses occupying the ground level. And those businesses are, you know, primarily retail, you know, operators who, you know, have historically served the community or are, some of them are new. And, you know, Sweet Auburn, just give you a little bit of geographic context, is, you know, the home of Martin Luther King Jr. is where the site lives, the National Park site lives. It's, you know, home to a lot of amazing, you know, Black-owned restaurants. It's a pinch between downtown Atlanta's primarily Georgia State campus and the Atlanta Beltline. So it's a lot of pressure, right? And like Georgia State is acquiring more land. The Beltline is generating a lot of economic activity in terms of new development. And so they're trying to figure out how do we position our businesses for success given all of this change that's happening around us. Not to note that it's also bisected by the interstate. So, you know, we understand that in terms of environmental racism. And so really understanding, hey, how are we looking at this place and these businesses in terms in positioning them for those growth opportunities? What I've learned from this process is, one, go slow. You know, it, and I really appreciate the intentionality of the organization in proceeding that way of how do we get it right? How do we not just like throw all the money at it and, you know, don't have enough capacity to really facilitate the program, don't do it really well, don't connect with the proper experts, et cetera. And, you know, because the difference between 3 months and a year is not necessarily a big gap because this program is operated on like a quarterly basis, right? So they support three businesses at a time each quarter. And so, you know, how do you do that well? And then what they've, you know, done to facilitate is actually a partnership with Savannah College of Art and Design, which has an Atlanta campus. You know, it's one of the nationally renowned design, actually internationally renowned design schools. And you know, they do really good work. And so these students are working with the businesses, hand in hand to understand how can we actually, you know, give them a solution that they can deploy. How do we refine those solutions? So that's what we're doing in the quarter, this coming quarter of, like, you know, from that first cohort, how do we go back to those businesses? Like, hey, what were you able to implement? What didn't work well? How do we use that learning to redesign the program as we're moving forward? And so it's this iterative process that I think most programs don't even think about and integrate, that I'm very, like, happy. You know, Luano, from the executive director of Sweet Auburn Works, had the foresight to do. And so, you know, we've been working in tandem with them to help stand that program up of, like, you know, what's the infrastructure needed in terms of the application? What questions do we need to be asking? How do we start to segment these businesses? Are they at the growth stage? Are they at the scaling stage? Are they at startup stage? Are they at the pivot stage? Are they at the, hey, maybe I shouldn't be operating this business stage, you know? And so, you know, being able to really assign some of those characteristics to them, and the fact that, you know, really supports kind of their vision and what they are choosing to do as their business is growing.
I could talk to you all day, but I know we have time limits, so we'll end on this question. What would be your last piece of advice for planners out there? What should they walk away with and kind of keep in mind when it comes to displacement? Because it's happening all over the country, unfortunately.
Yes. So a few things. I'm going to say the first thing is promote choice, right? You know, it is not your business. It is not your money. It is not your families that are at risk. It's theirs. And so when you think about equity, really think about talk to your neighborhood, those business owners about what would be best for them. Then help facilitate it. Next is advocate, you know, for what that looks like in written form and documentation, right? Like, you know, hey, we're doing small area plans, we're doing something, like, et cetera. And then, you know, also talking to elected officials, like, hey, do you actually realize what they want? Or what, you know, it's like, because a lot of times that communication gap is so wide, right? Of, like, where that's, you know, comfortability from business owners talking to, you know, elected officials or, you know, governmental representatives. And so it's just like, you know, being able to be that communicator. And then I think it's this also connection between this development community and the, you know, occupants, right? Of whether that's residents or the business owners that are occupying these buildings, is really being able to know yourself why these decisions are being made. So studying development finance, studying, you know, the actual approvals processes, et cetera, in order to really drive that conversation forward from a landscape of, I need to make sure they understand why they being the residents or the business owners, why these decisions are being made in terms of the industry of real estate. And so that translation piece, I think, is oftentimes missing in terms of the profession. We're very altruistic. We're very much so, like, community deserves what they deserve and want, et cetera, without necessarily having all the tools to communicate why or why not.
Fantastic. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for your time and sharing some of your insights with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
To hear more APA podcasts, visit us at planning.org/podcast. You can also find the APA podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.